So a lot of people ask me all the time, how is it that you do what you do being in your 40s? Well, it's a lot of hard work, but honestly, I got a lot of help. I've been going to Triple Threat Performance for my physical therapy needs for a few years now. I keep tearing this body down and they keep putting me back together again. And just recently, I joined their strength and conditioning program. And really, honestly, I don't think the mountains stand the chance this year. I feel stronger. I feel more flexible. I feel like I could go longer than I've ever had before in the past. So if you are in the Phoenix area and this sounds like something you might need or you want to up your game, check out Triple Threat Performance. That's ttpaz.com. ttpaz.com. Hey, I also want to give props to the Sneak Tech Sneak Boot. You heard me say it a million times. They're a game changer. And I'm not just saying it's not just lip service. They really are. They do what they're intended to do. And that is make a guy, woolly mammoth like myself, sound like a cat coming through the woods. And really just they're game changers. I think everybody should own a pair. It should be in your arsenal of weapons. And there is no other comparison out there. They're easy to put on, lightweight, easy to carry around with you. Don't take up a whole lot of weight and room in your backpack. It's almost foolish not to own a pair. So go check them out, Sneak Tech Sneak Boot.
Today, got a couple of friends on the line, and we're gonna have a little roundtable discussion about this thing that I keep seeing going on. About guided versus unguided, what makes you a good sportsman, what makes you a better hunter, this, and that. And, you know, it just keeps going on with this, you know, me pushing, not bashing fellow hunters thing. And in the last couple of weeks, I had a few incidents, so to speak, or few situations online, social media, where guys were just like really vocal about how they felt about other hunters using guides. And I had posted up on my Instagram, I did a podcast with my buddies out here, Big Chino Outfitters. I did a podcast with them on early season deer hunting in Arizona. And the guy saw my post, saw a guy, says Big Chino Outfitters underneath it, and it's, you know, saw a guy holding a big mule deer buck and the guide behind him with his hand on his shoulder. And I think he automatically assumed it was me. The guy in the picture kind of looks like me a little bit, maybe. And he said, oh, pay to hunt, such a true sportsman. So I kindly responded back to him. I said, if you are a hunter, you should support all legal and ethical hunting. That's a sportsman. And he says, I do, but paying money to harvest an animal isn't right. You know, so that's when I was like, okay, paying to hunt an animal. He started kind of getting underneath my skin a little bit. So I went back to him and I said, you're not paying for the animal. I said, you're paying for the experience of the guide. And how is that any different than you going hunting with a good buddy who knows the area better than you? Or going out of state and hunting with somebody who knows their area and you've never been there before. You know, I told them, you know, not everybody has the time to put in, to go scouting, this, and that. Or if they draw a really awesome tag and they've only shot 2 points their whole life and they drew a tag that they could shoot a 200-inch mule deer, maybe they just don't want to squander that opportunity because they know they're not going to be able to put the effort into to get out of that tag, you know. So we kind of went, and basically he ended up at the very end just saying, you're wrong, paying for an animal. He said, actually, I'll read it verbatim. Wrong, you are paying for the animal. Sorry, but if you have to pay someone to find animals for you, there's no way you should be considered a true sportsman. End of story. So that's where the fire got lit right there. But Before we go on any further, let me introduce who I
I
have
love
on
it
board
when John gets these
here.
fires lit. I
But
do.
you know me, man. I'm
I
pretty
know.
good. I let a lot of things roll off my shoulders, but you know, after a while, it's just like,
Yep.
no, I can't. So I have Charles Whitman with me. I have Mark Smith, Muley Slayer, and I have Randy Ulmer on the line today. And the reason why I chose this crew is Charles and I are both guides. We both hunted solo. We both hunted with friends. We both hunted with guides before. And I have Mark and Randy on because they're un how can I put this? Undeniably recognized as excellent hunters. And there's no question there that when you say either one of their names, that you don't think of them as an excellent hunter. And I never had this conversation with Mark, but I'm assuming you've used a guide before. I know Randy
Yes.
has. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So just real quick, just in case people don't know who the heck you guys are, just give a little quick bio. I'll start with you, Mark, since you're up.
Well, I am a Randy Ulmer wannabe. Been friends with
Aren't
Randy
we
for a
all?
long. Yeah, really, we all are. No, I just man, I'm started out blue collar hunter and then became a freelance writer and through Eastman's and some of the outdoor hunting magazines like a lot of guys. Luckily landed a spot on the Hoyt Hunting Pro Staff years and years ago and started emulating Randy Ulmer, hanging out, going to shoots, going to ATA and watching this guy going, man, this is the kind of guy I want to be, and I'm not trying to, but people know that about me and I'm not afraid or ashamed to say it because you got to set your sight somewhere. So anyway, built a name on being a public land hunter, and I write and I do a lot of seminars out at the Western Hunting Expo every year. I'm a regular writer for the Mule Deer Foundation. I'm a lifetime member of the Mule Deer Foundation, and I write in the MDF magazine bi-monthly. So that's probably where most people would see me. And I'm Muley Slayer One on Instagram, and I have a Facebook, which unless you're paying for ads, you're getting nowhere with Facebook these days. So anyway, that's a little about me. Shot 3D pro circuit for a little while, realized that wasn't my day job, went back to my day job and continued being a blue collar hunter.
There you
Public
go.
land hunter. Yeah.
Charles?
Yeah, I live in California now. I'm from Michigan. Grew up hunting all my life. And, now the last 8 years or something, my business that I own, it just affords me to hunt a lot more than most people can. So I hunt a lot. I can put a lot of time into it. And then I got into guiding as well, because honestly, I have the winters off for the most part, so I'm like, well, might as well go, try that out. And so I guide mostly pigs. I am actually guiding blacktail next week, which I'm really looking forward to that. That'll be different. And I'm just trying to be like John Stallone.
Oh, shut up.
Nice, nice.
And Randy Oler, the bow hunting Hall of Famer.
I'm a Mark Smith wannabe. I grew up in extreme rural Arizona, and my family, I hunted my whole life. Started shooting. So, and I've bow hunted since I was a teenager, and started shooting competitive archery, in my mid-20s, and spent a lot of time shooting professional archery. But my main passion has always been hunting mule deer and elk, and so that's primarily what I like to do now. I've hunted a lot of other species, but for the most part, I just truly enjoy hunting mule deer and elk.
And you do it so poorly.
Yeah.
If you've ever get a chance to go to Arizona Archery Club, you can see some of Randy's booners up there. He's got quite a few of them in there. It's pretty impressive. And by the way,
Yeah,
did you know
super.
that somebody shot one of your mounts by accident?
Well, you know, when I first when my wife first talked me into taking them all out of the house, I put them in there, and the guys there said, Kenny said, you know, I don't think we should put these up beyond the shooting line because somebody's going to shoot one. I said, you know, they've been shot before before they were mounted. I said, you got to promise me though, if one gets shot, you got to leave the arrow in it. Did he leave the arrow in it?
Yeah. Oh yeah. It happened like a week or two ago or last week. Oh, some cool kid was sky drawing and and punched his trigger and whacked the one that's furthest on the left hand side. I walked in there the other day. I was like, there's an arrow in the deer.
Was it a killing shot? That's the question.
Ah, yeah, I guess. I mean, the jugular.
I knew it. I knew it was going to be in the neck. Oh,
that's funny. So,
but I don't really know how to like even really direct this podcast to go where it needs to go. But I want to start. Let's start with like. Let's go ahead and start with you, Charles, since you just popped up on my screen. I like this program because it just keeps flipping through the camera angles, and Randy's not sharing video with us today, but
yeah,
because you were in on the argument, so maybe you kind of.
Yep. Well, it's a, you know, to me personally, it's a non-issue. It's whoever thinks this way and is unwilling to, you know, look outside of their box. To say that somebody's a sportsman or not, or say that somebody is, you know, not a true hunter. So number one, we're all entitled to our opinions. I have my opinions. When I see, you know, guys get, here's an opinion. When I see guys get monster hogs and a place where, you know, I know there's just hogs roaming around all over the place and I know it's really easy hunting, I'm not personally impressed with that. Okay.
Right.
If I see somebody get a monster hog on public land where I know it's like, you know, 3% of all hunters can even get one in California, I'm personally impressed with that. However, in no way, shape, or form am I going to say that person shouldn't be able to do that, or I'm not going to also, if it came to me, because we have to look at hunting as rights or privileges, however you want, you know, but if it came to me and there was, let's say, you know, legislation or something like that, I'm going to defend any type of legal hunting that there is. So that's where I think it gets dangerous. Because there is legislation. Right now, I'm currently literally dealing with this in California. There's legislation that's, it's not a bad bill, but within the bill is a section that the Humane Society was allowed to put in. Okay, now we're talking about California here.
That doesn't surprise me.
The bill's pretty cool, but they're allowed to put something in like this in, and what it does is it effectively bans any type of preserve hunting for wild pigs. So people can call that canned hunts or high fence hunts. I don't guide on anything like that, but we're talking, you know, and some of these are thousands and thousands of acres. You'd never know you're within a fence.
Right.
But in a lot of hunters, and I've come across the same thing where they start saying, well, that's not true hunting, or that's not this, and blah, 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 blah. Well, a lot of the guys, a huge percentage of the guys, this is why it's one of the reasons why it's really important. A lot of the guys who go to these ranches are disabled hunters, vets, kids, because they're listed as exotics. So you actually don't have to be 12 to go to these places. Some of these places have hunting schools where they're literally taking people from the cities who want to get into this. You know, San Francisco, I see it all the time. Like, man, how do I get into hunting? It's tough for somebody like that, you know, to get into it. So, but here's the thing. The Humane Society is able to get away with this because of complacency and because some hunters are just like, well, I don't care about that. But what you have to understand is they want to take away all of your hunting rights. And this is just the lowest hanging fruit on the tree. They're going to keep climbing that ladder and climbing that ladder. So you can have your own opinion, but we need to be aware that we're a minority here.
Right.
And with as far as hunting goes, there's a really good podcast that Stephen Rinella just had with the Sportsman's Alliance, which addresses this entire thing in all states and, you know, what the Humane Society is going to do. But, man, to quantify, to start saying, you know, this type of hunt is this and this type of hunt is that, that's only going to work against us. And it's right. It bothers me, and I think hunters should be ashamed when they're publicly, you know, voicing things like that, which all it does is cause division. And I don't think we,
division opens,
we need
up
to open
doors.
Our eyes a little bit, look outside of the box. There's, this might not be here, you know, in a while. I mean, they're banning, you know, all types of hunting with dogs. They tried banning all archery hunting in California.
Yeah.
Think about that. That's, and they got crazy pictures. Of course, they're going to use pictures of an arrow sticking out of an animal and how all archers are, you know, they're unethical and it's not an efficient kill and all that. I mean, that's really what we're looking at here. Have your opinion, but man, be smart about it.
Right. No, yeah, it makes sense. Makes sense. Yeah, anytime you cause division, you know, think about it. You're splitting two things. You're making a space in between those two things for something you don't want to wedge itself in between there, and that's, you know, Humane Society or anything else that's, you know, aligned with that. And
I don't know who this guy was that was talking, but I mean, man, most people, and we're not talking about any of us here, but most people, they get a week or 2 weeks off a year to hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? If you draw a tag and you got to go get a guide, you probably can't take a month off. You might be able to take a week or 2 weeks, and that's it. So you're paying for that guy's time. It's exactly what I do, because I have the time, just like what you were saying earlier. I got the time to put in where I can learn the land. I can learn the rhythm of the animals. Somebody pays me so I can try to get them on pigs. And where I'm at, it's not easy hunting. We get, you know, if we're pig hunting with a rifle, 1 to 2 opportunities in 2 full days. That's it. It's usually what it is. You know, it's not the kind of area where it's just not as open, you know, where you see them roaming around a lot. Mm-hmm. We're hunting hard. But I also know typically, because I, you know, when I'm there month after month after month, I know what's going on. So somebody wants to pay for that, they're, you know, they're paying for that experience where they get to just have that little bit of time off where they can go, you know, fill their freezer. But who cares anyways? How many of us, how many hunters, what's the percentage that still have to go to the grocery store to get meat? Most of us.
Right.
Not, you know what I mean? So think about it from that perspective.
Right.
So it's just getting your meat from here or getting your meat from there. Who cares? Who cares how you do it and who you went through and if it was on this land or that land or whatever else? It's so silly, and it's just, it's going to hurt us in the end.
Sure. Mark, you wanna pipe in?
Yeah, sure. My thing, man, is keep it real. I don't really care how people hunt with recurves or shotguns or rifles or bows or whatever behind a fence. I live in Texas. I'm from Texas. I lived in Colorado. I lived in New Mexico. I'm back in Texas. I've killed pinned up hogs and I've killed wild hogs down in the river bottoms. I've never seen a fence. It's fun. Shooting hogs is fun. Hunting's supposed to be fun, right? But I've seen and understand and can appreciate almost all aspects of hunting inside the continental United States. I've hunted Canada, Mexico, and the United States. I've never been to any other country, right? But what I expect for someone is if they're going to post a picture, he was saying this first segment, if you kill a 450-pound boar that's got giant tusks, but you went to a hog hunting ranch where all the boars have been cut so that they grow to be really big size and they got really big teeth, you know, don't belittle your hunting experience, but you don't say you did it another way. Just say what you did. Just say what you did, man. And you know, I really, on this subject, I've always dabbled in traditional archery. But the traditional hunting community has soured me so bad that I don't even touch my recurve anymore because I can't even share any experience about it on any of my social media that I can't say anything about it that I don't get critiqued. And then the next day, if I'm shooting my Hoyt, Well, then I'm just a poser or a wannabe. No, I just like it all, man. I like my Weatherbys. I like my Stalker stick bow. I like my Hoyt Carbon Defiant. I like all of it. And, you know, like the late Bill Kryn said, my writing mentor, he said, if they ever have a rock season, I want the smoothest, roundest, fastest, flattest throwing rock I can find. You know, it's whatever the most proficient weapon is. So on that subject, it's just the beating up on each other is absolutely ridiculous, man. And I don't have a problem saying things about it. But back on topic, I'm known as Muley Slayer. I lived in my resource to build my name with my passion grew to be a mule deer hunter because I lived in mule deer country. I lived in the Four Corners for a long time of New Mexico. So I could hunt Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, the Navajo Indian Reservation. There were a lot of Septembers I'd have five mule deer tags in my pocket. And I had two little kids and I was a refrigeration mechanic, you know, keeping Safeways running. So I would take my weekends and I would go kill four or five forked horns. And I kept doing that till I decided to shoot 3 points. Then I decided to only shoot 4 points. And then one year I decided I was going to shoot a Pope and Young deer. And I just kept growing as a person, as a hunter, as a conservationist. But I did it all on public land. But my very first mule deer hunt was when I was 24 years old and I moved to El Paso. There are no woods. There is no hunting opportunity anywhere around El Paso, Texas. It's just an isolated desert out in the middle of nowhere. And there's a little bit of hunting if you know somebody. But my closest opportunity to hunt was going to New Mexico. So I went over to New Mexico. I was over in Silver City working on a fur supermarket. I went up to this taxidermy shop when I first moved there and got a set of, they call it a proclamation. I got their proclamation. I started on the back. There was a bunch of outfitters ads. I pretty much threw a dart, picked an outfitter, went over there. This guy, not a reputable outfitter, but you know, it was, I was going to go hunting and the guy said, hey, I got a plan for, I got a deal for you. Bring a couple of buddies, $150 a day. We'll put you on some mule deer bucks. He took us over to what is unit 15, right, in the Gila. We went out to this airstrip, and there's 350 bulls laying. This is in August. There's 350 bulls laying everywhere. So mule deer hunting was going to be a caveat into elk hunting for us, right? We always wanted to even, I'd never even seen an elk in my life till that day. Anyway, we're in this old CJ, and we're bouncing around the Gila, and five big mature mule deer bucks cross this bar ditch, go up on this hill, and they stand there and look at the Jeep. And from that moment on, my passion for a mule deer was like, it just like blew me up. I saw that, and I couldn't believe what I was looking at, because I was used to hunting little East Texas whitetails, you know. And I seen these mule deer bucks. I saw these bulls, and the guy's like, man, $150 a day, you can go home with one of those. So we go over there. Man, me and two buddies bounce around the back of a truck, basically with arrows knocked on ice chests in National Forest for 3 days for $150 a day. And I told my buddy, I said, man, we can do this ourselves. Right. But I needed to see the ropes. Like, I don't even know what I'm looking for, how to do it. And, you know, even though it was a very poor, unsportsmanlike experience, I learned by going and paying to do it the wrong way, I learned how to do it the right way. Not to give outfitters a bad name, but this guy just was just looking for some quick cash. And we were young and we bid on it. That being said, my first ever Western hunt was a paid guided hunt, and they took us out. Then by fate, the next year, I was living in New Mexico as a resident, and then I would just turn myself loose, and I went all over everywhere you can go in the Four Corners looking for hunting opportunity, and I did it. And I've never – I was a guy that needed an outfitter. And to this day, in my seminars and stuff, when I do seminars back east, I tell everybody in the crowd – if you think you're going to go one or two times and you're trying to achieve different goals of getting a mule deer, unless you're going to go every year and be a mule deer guy, don't, if you live in Florida or Georgia or Illinois or something, man, find a good reputable drop camp kind of guy. Or if you don't have a friend, go with an outfitter so that you have the best experience, because it's not going to rob you. You still have to climb the mountain. You have to draw the bow. You have to shoot the animal. But man, if you're going to go once or twice, don't invest in all of the wall tents and the camping and the backpacking gear and all that. Get yourself a nice day pack, some gear, and go with an outfitter and go do that. And people that know me look at me like my hair's on fire. You know, they're like, man, that seems sacrilegious coming out of your mouth. No, the reason I say that is I was a Colorado resident for 8 years before I finally drew a sheep tag. And I had been hunting, bow hunting high country mule deer for over 10 years. I knew how to kill a high country mule deer, and I'd occasionally see sheep. And I'm thinking, there's no way a bighorn sheep is any savvier or wiser or craftier than a big mature mule deer buck. There's no way. I'm just going to go up there and climb around the rocks till I get within 80 yards and I'm going to hammer me a sheep. It's right. not going to even be a problem, right? 22-day vacation. Took every ounce of vacation I had that year from work. Talked to my boss, talked to my wife, got it worked out. 22 days on a mountain by myself, and I never drew my bow, and I ate the only sheep tag I've ever had. If I ever draw a sheep tag again, or if I ever get a Utah once-in-a-lifetime tag for a Shiras moose, mountain goat, anything like that, if I ever get an expo tag for a species that I really want, if I ever draw an Arizona strip tag, if I ever draw a Henry Mountains tag, I'm going to hire the best, most reputable outfitter for that species, and I'm going to pay whatever the price is because I want the best experience possible. Now, when I go back to my favorite hunting spots all over the Four Corners for mule deer, I know where to go and I know how to do it. But if I want to maximize my experience, I've already got the tag. The tag's going to be one or two of those in my entire life. No way, man. I'm going to go with a guy that's going to show me how to do it, where they're at. But I still have to climb the mountain. I still got to shoot it, and I still got to pack it out.
Take care of the raft.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. And I was kind of what I was, you know, I got into it a little bit more, more depth than that. But you know what? I'm going to give Randy a chance to talk first, and then I'm going to pipe in and kind of bring all of what you two guys have already said together and possibly what Randy's going to talk about.
Well,
Randy, what's your take?
Just for full disclosure, I'm a recovering guide. I guided for several years in Arizona and Nevada. I think the first thing is for full disclosure, when I was a kid, you know, I used to read Outdoor Life and Field and Stream, and my big goal in life at that point was to go on a out of state horse pack hunt with a guide. So even though we grew up not even thinking about that sort of thing, that was my dream. So I've always wanted to go hunting with a guide, and I always hunted on my own. And actually the first time I went on what I would call guided hunt, you know, in the Western states was, I had been hunting in Nevada, for 2 or 3 weeks and had gotten close to mule deer, but I was hunting by myself and I had been able to kill one. And a mutual friend of mine and Greg Crow kind of introduced us, said, "Hey, Greg's up there. You guys ought to get together." So Greg's probably one of the best, well, he is one of the best mule deer guides, in the West. And so we met out there in the field, and he said, "Hey, I got a deal for you. Well, first of all, if you're going to hunt mule deer, your chances of success way more than double if you have somebody helping you, and, you know, glassing from the opposite hillside, giving you hand signals or, you know, whatever, helping you." And so Greg says, "Well, listen, if you'll guide for me, I'll help you." And so we had an agreement where I'd help him, and he helped me. And, you know, I'd been hunting for a couple of weeks up there by myself. And once Greg started helping me, you know, it was just so much easier because I had a second set of eyes, and I ended up killing a pretty decent buck. And so we became fast friends, and we started hunting together. And as a matter of fact, Greg actually found the biggest buck I've ever killed, and was kind enough to let me shoot it. And well, as it turns out, the next year, or the year before actually, I shot that buck, I found a giant buck in Nevada and told Greg about it. And as far as I know, I think that's the biggest buck Greg's ever killed. I mean, killed personally. He may have killed big ones, but it was actually the state record for Nevada. And I don't know if it still is archery. But my point is, you know, Greg was a friend of mine and we hunted together, but I was going on guided hunts. Greg was guiding me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had no issue with that. And now, you know, my whole goal in life is to be in a position where I could spend my late summers scouting and hunting. And I finally got to that point where I can take a lot of time off, and I spend 30 to 45 days in the high country every year scouting, just because that's what I love to do. But if I draw or buy a Nevada tag, I have a friend over there now, Sean Lytle, that, you know, I'd rather spend my time looking for big deer here. And right. If I get a tag over there, Sean will have looked around and tell me where to go. And my nephew Zach and I hunt together all the time. But Zach's, you know, he's a family man now, and he doesn't have time to go and help me. So, you know, I'll hire Sean. And it's not like, you know, he's not cooking me dinner. He's not doing any of that. And I'm as likely to find the deer as he is. But I've got help over there. And you know, Sean's found a couple of pretty nice bucks for me, really nice bucks. And I actually found and helped Sean kill the second biggest buck he's ever killed. So, you know, it's kind of a mutual thing. But I've got no personal issues about hiring a guide. I think most of my best hunting buddies are guides. And, you know, I'll help them and they'll help me. So I've got no issue with that. And also, you know, I drew a Wyoming tag, and in Wyoming, you have to hire a guide for a sheep tag.
And sheep tag, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, I've got no issue with that. And then when I go to Alaska, you have to hire a guide there. Got no issue with it. You know, the only issue I have is I just don't like hunting with a guide that, won't let me actually make the final decisions on how I want to approach the animal and how I want to hunt the animal. You know, they're great at finding them. They know the country. And most guides love hunting, and most guides are very personable, very friendly. So it's enjoyable to spend time with them. But yet, I drew a sheep tag here in Colorado after 30 years of applying, and I thought about hiring a guide. I said, no, this is something I want to do on my own, because I had plenty of time. So I spent 18 days scouting, and it was a rough, nasty unit with not very many sheep. And in those 18 days of scouting, I never saw a good ram. But anyway, my nephew came up, and we hiked in there, and an old veterinary school buddy of mine came up, and, you know, I was able to kill a sheep, and it's very rewarding. And it wouldn't have been as rewarding for me had I hired a guide. And same thing, I had an Arizona sheep tag and a Nevada sheep tag, and I probably would have killed a bigger sheep if I'd hired a guide that knew the area, but something I kind of wanted to do on my own. But the whole issue of people thinking that you're a lesser hunter because you hire a guide is really ludicrous. Some people absolutely don't have the time, you know, busy doctors or attorneys or whatever, and they just want to go and have a good experience, and they don't want to flounder around. And it doesn't mean they're any less of a sportsman. It just means that they want to have a quality experience. They may not want to pack up a tent and all their gear and spend all the time that we enjoy spending getting all that stuff ready. They just want to go have a fun hunt. Mm-hmm. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with that, in my opinion. Now, I think what your adversary may have been talking about is there are hunters and that I know, and I don't mean to disparage them, but they're more collectors than they are hunters. And
oh yeah.
And they'll go and they'll do what I call quote unquote canned hunts, where they spend a lot of money to shoot the biggest animal they can, and they'll fly in and the guide will have the deer found. They'll fly in and stroll out there and shoot the deer and then fly home and brag to their buddies that they're a great hunter. And I think that's probably what really bothers a lot of people, is those guys kind of beating on their chest and saying what great hunters they are when they don't, you know, they're not out there wearing out their boots like we are, you know, pounding the mountains. And those guys, you know, and I'm not even, I mean, those type of people put a lot of money into the hunting community. So I have nothing against them, except for when they kind of pound their chest about how great a hunter they are. So, yeah, you know, that's.
You know what, though? It's just there's such a small percentage of the hunting public or the hunting community that it's a shame that the acts of a few, you know, it's just like anything else. A few bad seeds, you know, always screw up the crop, you know.
Well, they're the most visible ones out there.
Exactly. That's the thing.
Not to the hunting public necessarily, but to the non-hunting public. So it kind of gives us a little bit of a black eye. And I think that's why people tend to not like the way those guys hunt.
Right. Yeah. I think for each person, like you were kind of alluding to it. So I've gone on guided hunts. I'm a guide myself. And I've hunted solo, and I've hunted, you know, with friends. And I have friends, like almost everybody I hunt with, all my close buddies are a guide in some way, shape, or form in their own right. You know, they're all very high-level hunters. Most of the people that I hunt with, except for a few of my family members, you know, are all capable of guiding people. You know, all have the knowledge and experience. And I think it's just different levels of like what, yes, when I go hunting with a guide, it's not the same experience for me. Like, I don't feel quite as accomplished as if I, you know, threw a dart at a map and went in there by myself completely, didn't talk to anybody, didn't get any information from anybody, whatever, and found the deer, shot a deer, packed it out myself, you know, the whole bet. Of course, the more effort, the more time you put into something, the bigger the reward emotionally or whatever is going to be. Like, one of my favorite deer that I've ever shot is literally a 2-point little, like, 70-inch 2-point mule deer that I shot. And it's because of how much effort I put into it and what I did to shoot that deer. But at the same token, like, I know what it is to be guided, and I know what it is to guide people. Like, for me, there's no freebies. There's no gimmies. Like, when a guy comes hunting with me for coos deer or even javelina, okay? They're the ones stalking. I'm not leading them around by the hand, you know? I might be on a radio talking to them and telling them, you know, helping them pick a route or telling them what the deer is doing or telling them what, you know, pig's doing or whatever. But they still have to read the wind. They still have to move quietly. They still have to make the shot. They still have to... It kills me that people take away, like, that you don't have the skill to get it done on your own. That's why you're with a guide. They don't, like, look at the big picture. Ironically enough, that podcast I did with Big Chino, in the podcast, he's talking about one of his clients shooting a really big buck, like a 200-inch buck. And he's telling him that this guy keeps coming back year after year, has been with him for like 14 years, how much he has learned from his client on how to stalk and hunt deer. And that resonated with me. I was like, I do the same thing. Like, I've had hunters come in that are probably better hunters than me, but they don't know coos deer and they don't know Arizona. So they come here for they get the two pieces of the puzzle from me that they don't have. You know, they pay me for my knowledge of the area, where to find them, and that deer's behavior. But the rest is all on them. You know, Mark said it before a little bit, like, he doesn't like when people, you know, tell him how to hunt, or maybe that was you, Randy, I don't remember, but most guides don't tell you, unless they'll only give you how much information. I know everybody who works for me, they'll only give you how much information you want. Or, I mean, you may need more. You may need more, but, you know, but they'll only give you how much you want. And, I mean, I'm sure there's a couple of guys out there that just like, okay, we're going to go over here, and this buck shows up over here at 5 a.m. every morning, and just, I want you to draw back now because he's going to step out here in 3 seconds. It's like, I know that goes on. Goes on. And I know there's a lot of outfitters out there, especially the guys that are taking really giant trophy, like, and they're selling giant trophy hunts, even though they're on public land. And I'm not going to single out anybody, but you know who they are. They have those animals so well patterned. They got people sitting on them all year long. That yes, that is, you know, that's a different ball game. But it's such a small percent. You know, even guys who hunt private land don't do that. They don't like, yeah, they know their land or whatever, but they don't like. I guide people in South Dakota. I don't live in South Dakota. I live here in Arizona. It's private land. I don't see that place till you show up there. I show up like a day before you do, and that's it. And like, you know, it's just, I don't know. For me, I think Charles was kind of hitting it on the head. It's just the constant division and allowing the fighting in between us kind of just, it's hurting us. It's going to make things go away.
Well, there's no real way to remedy it. I mean, there are, for instance, the public land, private land thing. Did you get it on public or did you get it on private? Well, I know plenty of areas where it's easier to get on game on public land than it is on private.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, that doesn't
mean anything. Where we've been hunting in California.
Right. Yeah. It's not easy at all. But I had a question. Yeah, so Randy brought up Alaska. So, you know, by anybody who thinks this way, what, every Alaska hunt that's ever taken place isn't a real hunt? I mean, you got to have a guide there. You know, it's just, it's so silly. And then when does it change the second that you pay? Or does it change the second that you have a guide? So like what some of you guys were talking about, I don't know if you were saying you paid each time, because it sounded like sometimes you were with your friends. I mean, what's the difference? So if I come out, I'm going to come out to Arizona with John, and let's say we're hunting coos deer. I've never hunted a coos deer, hunted a lot of whitetail. I've never hunted in Arizona, don't know anything about it. And let's say, you know, he's just like, yeah, come on out, and he's glassing for me. So he's guiding me. But let's say I don't pay him. Like, is there a, like, what's the difference? The second you pay, or are we talking about if you're hunting with a partner that's helping you, then it's not a real hunt? I mean, we can all come up with the worst case scenarios, like what you were saying, where, you know, a trophy buck comes out, they got him patterned, and the guy, you know, gets that. Well, hey, if you got a spot where you can accomplish that, and you can bring somebody in off the streets, and you're like, yeah, I know this area so well, and this is what you're going to get. More power to you. Right. I mean, that's not how 99.9% of hunting goes. But if you can find that 0.1% and pull that off for a little bit, okay.
Right.
You probably got more power to you. I mean, it's like, I look at it like capitalism. I mean, it's like, you know, hey, it's fair ground. You're not doing anything illegal. You figured something out. Not always going to be like that. You know, I mean, I don't know. It's just hard to, and of course, what the outside world sees is going to be, you know, anytime anybody hunts anything in Africa or whatever, anytime somebody just sees a picture of somebody with an animal, the outside world, they just like, oh, trophy hunter, just getting it for the head. That's it. It's hard. We need to be aware of that. You know, I mean, I don't really anymore, but I used to, and this is the first guy that I'm thinking of, because I've been watching him since the 80s, and he's still on. But if I was just to take somebody in San Francisco who, you know, grew up in San Francisco, has never hunted before, and show them an episode of Roger Raglan, I'll just, you know, they're going to be like, what the heck? I understand it. I'm from Michigan. I've hunted out of tree stands. I've hunted deer. Now, I get the excitement that hunters get. I get it when they get loud and all that. Believe me, it's, man, the problem is that as hunters, we can understand these things and these emotions, but it doesn't translate to the outside world. I'm not even saying that's a problem. That's just, it is what it is. And it's really hard to, that's our challenge if we want to give hunters put hunters in a different light and maybe bring in new hunters. That's why me personally, I really like to show in my pictures, I'm always going to show the animal in me, and usually I got a big smile. Sometimes I don't. Sometimes I've, got the pictures where I'm showing reverence, all that. But my favorite thing to do is to show the meat and the pack out. I'm trying to accomplish that. But if you don't, I don't care. It's not like you have to do that. I'm not saying anybody has to do these kind of things. I'm trying to step out of the box. And I've brought in a lot of hunters that have never hunted before. People that grew up in San Francisco, who that was the last thing they'd ever think of. You know what I mean? Then they'd never really seen anything besides pavement and concrete and tall buildings. But that's just sort of what my goal is. So we gotta step off our soapboxes, and while us in private we can sit around and we can agree, like, yeah, this guy, blah 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 blah. It's not, he's not a he's coming off looking like an NBA player, but he's just playing on the streets. I mean, we you know what I mean? It's, but we got to be careful with that. You guys understand what I'm saying? It's just a I'm looking at the hunting. I'm looking at my kids and my grandkids and their grandkids. I want hunting to survive. That's what we got to focus on. That's what we have to remember here. So, I mean, you can look at anything. There's going to be all sorts of this guy does it like this. This guy does it like any industry, anything. It's humanity, right? I mean, we're people. So it's human nature. We're always going to have this, but we just got to keep our, I guess, our eye on the prize here, and the prize is us still being able to do this, which is ridiculous that we even, I mean, mankind is here essentially because of hunter-gatherer and what meat and fat does to our brains and survival and all that. And now we're here in this crazy industrial revolution, but I mean, we're here because of all this. And for us to even debate this, I mean, that's a whole different subject, but we just gotta, we gotta be smart about this kind of stuff.
For sure.
But Charles, this is Randy. Charles, you brought up some great points. One thing that came to my mind is I have a lot of friends that are long time guides. They've been guides for a long time. And I was thinking, okay, so we know they're great hunters and we know they can get it done on their own. But of all my friends that are serious hunters, that are long-term guides, I cannot think of one of those guys that hasn't gone on a guided hunt themselves. So that's a pretty good argument against the fact that anybody that goes on a guided hunt isn't a, a true sportsman or a good woodsman or a good hunter.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I
When I
mean,
first moved to California, I went on a guided hunt for pigs because I was, number one, pigs were like an alien to me. I didn't know. I was like, wow, this is just a cool creature running around. I don't come from the land of pigs, in Michigan. And but I didn't know where to go. I was new to California, no idea where to hunt, in California. And I went on a guided hunt for pigs, and I was so excited and so happy. Number one, to get a pig, to fill my freezer with meat that wasn't from the store. I mean, I was kind of raised on a farm and things like that, so it was still really important to me. I wanted to, if I can, eat meat that somehow I went out and touched in some way, shape, or form when it was alive. That's just how I like to do things. So yeah, I've gone on three total guided hunts in my life. Now I've learned California. I figured it out. I don't need to. I don't need to, mostly because I have the time. I mean, I can put a lot of time in the hunt. John and I just got done hunting 7 days straight, and well, no, John got a pig, but we didn't get deer. That's mainly because we suck. But the very next week, I went back out hunting. I mean, that's a lot of time already, and I'm not even done. It's just That's just my personal situation. I went back out and I got a great buck, but I got the time. I've put a lot of time in the scouting, a lot of time, but man, not everybody can do that. Most people, they got, like I said before, you got 2 weeks vacation and that's all you got. And as far as, you know, so when you guys were talking about guiding and being able to let, you like it when a guide sort of lets you do your own thing. And yeah, I've had similar situations. I would say that that's it's a situational thing, because sometimes I have a lot of hunters that are new hunters that are relying on me for everything. And then there's some guys who hunt a lot and they just, you know, they're, one guy I'm thinking of, he's a professor and he just wants to get, the guy hunts a lot. When he gets time off, that's what he's doing, but he doesn't have the time for scouting and all that. But he's a good hunter. He knows what he's doing. And, you know, he wants me to just be sort of there with him and things like that. And it's almost like for companionship.
Show him where the pigs are or show him where the deer are and that's it.
And then he wants to go on a stalk, and that's his favorite thing, man. We've gone on like 2-hour stalks where we see stuff, you know, and he just, you know, he's hunting. And so there's kind of a fine line there, because as a guy, if somebody's paying you, I'm feeling the responsibility of, I want to make sure this person gets an opportunity. And sometimes they might make a decision where it's like, ah, I got a better one for you. You know what I mean? So you're working that too. And every situation is different. Every situation is completely different, of course, but there is a kind of there's a fine line there. Obviously, if Randy Ulmer came out, I'm not going to be like, ah, you might, you know, make sure you got the wind right. I'm pretty sure you know that. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it just depends on who you're hunting with. And I try to get to know, one of the first things, conversations when I'm talking to somebody is, you know, what have you hunted before? How long have you been hunting? You know, tell me about, what's your effective range? You know, if we're bow hunting, it gets even more, because some guys, you know, they just, it might be their first time bow hunting. It's like, whew, this is going to be tough, you know? So it just, you got to gauge everything and get all the information that you can and just try and make it the best experience you can for the client.
Yeah.
You know, so you guys get it.
Yeah.
Well, this is Randy again. A good example, I am actually going on a hunt this fall in late September to British Columbia. And it's a hunt I've dreamed of literally since I was a pre-teenager, and I'm finally able to do it. It's a guided moose hunt and caribou hunt in northern British Columbia. And, and we'll be on horseback for 14 days. And
that's awesome.
I've been to British Columbia before, and it's the most beautiful place in the world. But I'm going guided. Now, does that mean I'm a lesser hunter? Could I do this on my own? No, I don't have the wherewithal. I don't have the horses. I don't know the country. But it's someplace I've always wanted to be, and something I've always wanted to do is go on one of those extended horseback hunts. And you have to fly into the base camp because they've trailed the horses in for 50 miles. So does that mean that I'm a lesser hunter because I'm going guided? Well, if I weren't willing to go guided, that's an experience that I would never have. Mm-hmm. So, again, another good argument as to why just because you're going on a guided hunt doesn't mean you're a lesser sportsman.
Hey guys, just a real quick break. Pardon the interruption. I want to talk to you about becoming a patron of the show. It's super easy. You just go to the Interviews with the Hunting Masters on my Podbean account, and at the top right-hand corner, you'll see a green button that says Become a Patron. Or if you're using the Podbean app, it's right there. Just click on the button, Become a Patron, from any of the episodes. I really go out of my way not to bombard you with a bunch of ads and clutter up the episodes. I really like to keep it as educational and as valuable as possible. I'd like to add to that value by adding some bonus episodes that are going to be just for the patrons only. I'm going to release a few that are strictly for those of you who have contributed to the podcast. it really goes a long way. And I want to say it again, that even a dollar a month, pledging a dollar a month, $12 a year may not seem like a whole lot, but it means the world to me. It helps me take care of the cost of producing this show. And I really appreciate it. And I'd appreciate you guys. Thanks for listening. And let's get back to this episode.
Exactly. I mean, by this guy's definition of what a true hunter, true sportsman is, I don't think any, I mean, there's probably a handful of people that go out in the woods, cut down a tree, whittle themselves a bow, you know, right. make a horse hair string, you know,
yeah.
strap some bamboo arrows on their back and head out into the great yonder by themselves, shoot a deer, throw it over their back and bring it back, cut it up, eat it, whatever, themselves. I mean, how many hunters actually do that?
Not me. A whole lot. I'd be pretty dang impressed if somebody does that. Okay. That's a good point, though.
I mean, and if you're hunting with friends, I mean, and they're helping you achieve your goal in some shape, way, or form, they're guiding you. I mean, I do it all the time. I mean, here in Arizona, I mean, we use radios. I go hunting with one of my hunting friends or my buddies here, or my cousins, whatever. A lot of times I even hunt with the guides that work for me. Okay. They're talking me in on a radio. When it's their time to turn to stalk, I talk them in on a radio. So what does that mean? I'm not a good hunter. I mean, I get paid to hunt. I mean, I don't know. Like, it's just, the argument to me, there was a lot of people that would pipe in on that whole thread. And I saw it came up a few times and it infuriated me. They were trying to take the side, and I don't know if basically what was said was, oh yeah, but not everybody has the skill. Not everybody has the skill to go hunting. And like that itself is condescending. They were trying to say, oh, I don't have a problem with guiding because some people need it. Like, you know, and I don't know. Like for me, that it's like, maybe some people just want it. Did you ever think that, you know?
Hey,
I don't know. It's just
yeah,
don't necessarily have to have skills to want to hunt. And just because you're not a skilled outdoorsman and a skilled woodsman doesn't mean you shouldn't be able to experience hunting. Maybe it's somebody that just wants to find out what hunting's all about. Like some of the people that hunt with Charles, it's something that should be available for everybody, and people shouldn't be judged just because they ask for help.
Yeah.
There were guys who were up with the outfitter who wanted to be taught. I mean, this seems silly, but we're not all raised the same, who wanted to be taught how to cut wood.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, mm-hmm. That's cool. You know what? They could teach me something, probably about building websites and writing code. You know what I mean? I mean, it takes all kinds. And we shouldn't put a negative light on anybody who wants to go hunting, because you don't know their situation.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, and that's one thing that, I mean, there's an assemblyman here in California, and he was saying, oh, disabled vets, we're not taking away their hunting. They can go. I'm like, oh, really? So a dude with no legs, he's going to go where I'm hunting? I mean, how am I going to do this? But the guy still wants to get out there. And if we can set him up on something, because I mean, and mostly I talk about pigs, you know, there's barley fields here in parts of California where, man, it's insane the amount of pigs, and you can bring people out and they're going to get an opportunity, you know, with a rifle, you know, have them on a side by side or something. You just sit for a little bit and the pigs just come out like it's insane. But on ranches and things like that, outfitters, all that land is private for the most part. And it's managed. If it was public, it'd be run over pretty quickly, I would imagine. But you just got everybody's got a different situation, and it's more than ourselves. Your situation is your situation, but the hunting world's a big, big world. Big
Right.
world.
Well, I think some of our listeners may think that Mark has either died or has been
Yeah, I would
disconnected.
say
Mark, what are your thoughts on that? He's
tying knots. I've seen him tying knots.
You know what, man? I get so frustrated. I love Jesus, but I cuss a little. And when I get really upset, man, my vocabulary shrinks. So I try not to engage in too much controversy. And but what I do say is I say what I mean what I say, and I say it flat out. And I went back and read the thread after you invited me to be on this because we were going to do another podcast. And you invited me, so you said, "Hey, there's this controversy. Do you want to be a part of it?" And I said, "Sure, I'll be a part of it." And I went back and read the thread, and the guy that started all this, the things he's saying are. Well, you know how I felt about it in our text message. It's just the guy was, it's just probably ignorance, probably just
Yep.
ignorant. He just doesn't know what he's talking about, for one. Number two, green-eyed monster jealousy. I've been reading the threads for years on forums about how people scout or how they kill stuff and guided and all that. And I used to get so engaged. Anymore, I just don't care.
Right,
I'm
right.
48, but I'm 48 and I need to be a voice for conservation, a voice for hunting, my passion, what I love. I want my grandsons to hunt and have the opportunity. So I do everything I can to educate and bring the non-hunting crowd a nice positive image,
Of
of
course.
hunting and how it should be and what's right and what's wrong. Back on topic of guided, non-guided, semi-guided, Randy couldn't go fulfill a lifelong dream because in Canada you have to have guides, right? Or in Alaska you have to have guides. He can't even, you're going to say, let's just deny him of this. He saved his whole life, or he's done whatever he's done to have the means to go do what he wants to do. But because your opinion is that's not the right way to do it, Randy goes, "Okay, you're right. I'm just not going to go do this because I care about what you think or how you feel about me doing it. You can go kick rocks, Holmes. I'm going to go do what I want to do." The next thing is, like where I elk hunt, Randy knows this probably better than either one of you other two guys because we have been friends and followed each other for a long time, is I really did build my name and my reputation 100% on DIY public land. I mean, that started with Eastman's. When Cameron Haynes first became the editor of Eastman's Bowhunting Journal, I think one of my very first article was one of his very first articles he ever edited, right? So that was like in 2000. And
Cool.
I got my start as a writer through that awesome opportunity, right? And that just where hunters can showcase and learn how to write, and you watch what they edit and you learn to be a little better writer each time. It's a really awesome deal Eastman did. I really like that. But I built this reputation as, man, this guy just goes out every single. I never kill Boone and Crockett deer. I've never killed a Boone and Crockett deer, but I have killed a pile of them. And I would get nice ones, good enough to be in the Hoyt catalog, right? So we have this whole controversy. Yeah, hey, don't. And that was my goal. I swear to you, when I made Hoyt
Yeah.
Pro Staff, it's like I arrived. I am the man. I'm right next to Cam and Randy and Michael Waddell, and I'm right in here with the guys. Well, if the whole hunting community decides together, hey, we can't take pictures with our bows and propped up in front of dead animals anymore, guess what? Hoyt's probably not going to send you any more bows because they're counting on that for promotional
Oh,
products.
yeah.
You know what I mean? They need, Matthews needs a John Stallone photo for social media every once in a while. Hoyt has a catalog every year. They need that. My goal every year was, I'm not looking for a Pope and Young deer. I'm not looking for a Boone and Crockett deer. I'm looking for a buck that I can make really look, because I want the meat. I'm a meat hunter. But my buck's got to be big enough to look nice in a Hoyt catalog. That's just, isn't that stupid? But in my 30s, that's what it was all about. I needed to look good. Now, some part of the hunting community says, well, you can't take pictures with your animal propped up with a bow anymore because that looks really distasteful. It's going to be hard. Well, you clean the blood off, make it look good, set way back. Don't set too far back. You look like an idiot, but make it look good. Sell some bows for them, make yourself look good, build a name for yourself. But anyway, That's a whole nother soapbox. I was a guy that built my name on public land. But on my elk hunting spot in Colorado, and believe it or not, I can find a spot that's 10 miles from any trailhead. That's where a lot of elk are, and I killed a lot of really nice bulls in there. It is very irresponsible to go by yourself 10 miles in and think you're going to get an entire 900, 800-pound, 1,100-pound bull elk out, mature bull, on your back when it's straight downhill for, you know, 6 miles of this 10-mile trek. And you kill the bull in the middle of the day, it's still getting in the 70s and 80s. You're not going to get it all out. So I found an outfitter years ago that I gave him $300. I always had $300 cash waiting in my truck. When I got a bull down, I'd hike out the next day, call him on the cell phone, give him GPS coordinates, and he would ride in. He'd get all my elk. By the time I got all my gear out back to Colorado, back to town, my meat and my head and my cape and my trophy and everything was hanging in his freezer ready to go home with me and my Jeep. I talked about that in a seminar once, and this guy, I noticed him kind of get up and walk out. And after the seminar, I walked out there and I started talking to him. I was like, "Hey, man, what'd you get out of that? Did you enjoy it?" He goes, "Yeah, but I thought you were like 100% DIY." I said, "I am 100% DIY. Well, those aren't your." I was like, "Do I actually have to feed and own the mules and walk the mule in myself to be the real DIY public land hunter?" I paid for a service because it was the responsible thing to do. Randy's paying because it's the legal thing to do. And it's just like, if you don't have enough hunting experience to understand the things I just talked about, you probably shouldn't be popping off on John Stallone's Instagram page, in my opinion.
Yeah.
That's the way I see it.
Well, that's usually it's usually the people who are popping off or the guys that are or don't have the experience. You know, Charles and I were talking about this not too long ago. There's so many people out there. "Oh, I've been bow hunting for 30 years. I've been bow hunting for 20 years. And then I'm like, "Okay, cool. So how many days a year do you spend the field?" "Oh, you know, 10, whatever."
Yeah.
I'm like, I spend about 90 to 100 days a field and have been for 18, 19 years.
Mm-hmm.
So you do the math on how many days. And I never want to be that guy. I hate when I get into arguments on social media. I never want to be that guy. I don't, you know, who wants to come compare trophy rooms, you know, whatever. I don't want to be, you want to compare resumes. You don't want to be that guy. So what I keep telling people, I'm like, "Listen, you get into these arguments, give them the knowledge, you know, say, "Hey, no, you're wrong. This is the way it is, blah, blah, blah." And just walk away from it, because people get set in their ways. They're going to, you know, they're going to believe what they want to believe, and you're not going to change their mind. Yeah. You know, you might be able to educate a few people, and there might be, you know, if they're smart enough, they'll go look into it and then reform their opinions. But, you know, Charles was talking earlier about getting the public, you know, changing the view in the public eye. I mean, we can't even change the view amongst ourselves. How the frick are you going to change the, you know, the public eye? It's just not—it's not going to happen.
Yeah, I think a lot of people's motives are for the wrong reasons from the get-go. They have a really perverted idea of what they're even out to try to accomplish, and you can see it. And social media is to thank for most of all of that kind of stuff.
Well, it's just gotten worse. It's just grown exponentially because of social media, because it's in everybody's face. Social media, when you and I were kids, you know, or when all of us were kids, Randy's older than us a little bit. Sorry, Randy. But, you know, in the 80s, we'd strap the deer to the hood of the car and drive it to the city center. And
that was the only way to do it.
That was social
media. Man, that was Michigan.
It was where I'm from, too. You know, I would think about this sometimes. My great grandfather owned a fish market, and he was a fur trapper. He was born in like 1895 and he died in 74. So I knew him a little bit, but my dad and my cousins, that are just a generation older than me, they all grew up hunting and fishing with him. And he ran this fish market. You know, he could go down to the river and catch fish back then and then just sell them. And then he'd sell the coon hides and stuff, and then he'd sell the meat and the possums and things to the folks there across the tracks. And it was, you know, it was just a different, simpler time. And sometimes I started out hunting that way. That's why I hunted, not for any other thing other than purely a resource for, you know, I sold coon hides as a kid and all that stuff and frog legs and all those things. And I ate everything that I hunted. And sometimes when I see some of the nonsense the hunting community fights about and puts on social media, I really have the thought of my grandpa would say, what in the hell's going on over here? He wouldn't know what's wrong with that boy. There's something wrong with him. Funny guy. He was very simple and a great man, but it just, I talked about this in a podcast the other day with a friend, and I said, you know, there's no true sanctions on hunting, and there shouldn't be any sanctions on hunting, but the terminology that make us all, what do they call that, keyboard warriors and all these, all these Instagram pros and all this stuff is you can't go play for the Dallas Cowboys without the credentials, right? But you can, or 49ers or Lions, yeah, or whoever, gotcha. Cardinals for you, buddy, whatever. but I'm a Cowboy fan, sorry. But
I'm afraid to tell you who I'm a fan of.
I can't run over there to Jerry's World and throw on a helmet and go blocking for Dez and those guys because I don't have the criteria. But anyone can go to Walmart and buy a Savage 270 and a real tree John Deere cap and jump online and say, you bought my new 270. I'm a professional guide and hunter today. Yep. You know, we that's a whole different thing, but there's nothing to say you are, you aren't. Mm-hmm. And then when you get when you get a certain amount of these people, remember what I said early on, just say what you are, do what you say you're going to do and be that person. When you get enough of those folks with, like you said in that text message, just enough following to sway people to believe one way or another, we're fighting like an internal terrorism group. When we say fighting amongst ourselves and Mark fighting, that's Mark, Randy, and John fighting against posers that come on your thing and beat you up because they see some guy with a guide. Anyway, that's, I don't know what that's got to do with the price of tea and Aztec, but you know, it all kind of goes together, really. I mean, it does go together. It's all opinions and there's no way to control it other than be a good person and put out a good product and do the right and take the time to have a civil conversation. And that's what I try to do. But as soon as anything on my social media goes no longer civil, any swear words and any derogatory remarks towards people that I actually know, I just, it's so easy to swipe, delete, block, and you're gone, man. I'm moving on. You're just not going to do that on my stuff. And that I try to control it, and some people thrive on it. And I commend you for stepping up to the plate for all of us today. I appreciate you doing it. I know it struck a nerve, but
yeah,
some things do have to be said. Some things have to be said, man.
I brought it to the public afterwards. You know, I wanted to know what people's opinion were on it. And there was quite a bit of people that were like us, had the same philosophy. Yay, you know. But there was enough people that still had a little, like, there was a stigma about it, and I just felt like it was something that needed to be talked about because, you know, I think honestly Charles said it the best in the beginning. Like, it is allowing for antis to come in and take away what you want. Like, you got it. We all got to like lock arms and show a unified front, because I could guarantee you that the PETA guys aren't warring with the Humane Society, you know, mm-hmm. the Save the Kitty Cats of America is not warring with the doggies of the puppies of America when it comes to these issues. They all are going to lock arms. They're all going to be unified and so on and so forth. And they're just,
they're better organized. It's not just ourselves. There's a whole world watching.
Yeah. And the world doesn't know anything.
It's often said that hunters are the greatest conservationalist, right? Not because of what we're doing necessarily, but just because of purchasing licenses and tax, right? All the money that goes to that. We got to keep that in mind too. So we're going to, you know,
but the
shy away
hunters
or something like that. We're going to shy away hunters and then. Right.
You know that?
But what I'm saying is each time any hunter purchases a license or a tag, money is hopefully going towards, you know, depending on your state, the biologists and the wildlife programs. I mean, you got to keep that in mind too. What would it be without that? What would it be without the balance? We're just another predator. I mean, we're the one on top of the food chain. We're the one with the intellect. We're the one with the tools. But we're very important in this whole cycle.
Oh yeah, there wouldn't be. It wouldn't be anything because 100% of conservation comes from, you know, either the excise tax, tag sales, or donations from us. There's no, you know, you don't donate money to Humane Society. It's going to pay for lawyers to lobby against hunting. That's what it's going. That's what it's going to.
1%
it's not going
of
to.
It. Yeah. 1% of it goes to, when you see the Sarah McLachlan videos, goes to actual pounds, to like dog pounds and stuff. 1% of that money.
Yep.
That's a fact.
Because by law, it has to. That's the only reason. The rest all goes to, yeah. It's crazy.
The rest goes to DC and fighting, essentially hunting.
Right.
In meat eating or something like that, or, you know, milk is meat too, something, whatever, you know.
Milk is meat too.
I
actually, today at the gym, there was
see
like,
a lot
there's,
of that out here.
There's six high school athletes that I work out with because at Triple Threat, they train all athletes, and I got to weasel myself in there like an athlete. But I asked, we were talking about something, and it kind of came up in the subject, and I'm like, hey, do you guys know what conservation is? And they all, you know, they all shook their head, yeah, you know. They had a somewhat idea what conservation is. I said, do you guys know how conservation is paid for? And I asked everyone said, oh, it comes from the taxpayers, I said, you're all absolutely wrong. This is how it gets paid. So, like, this is going on a completely different tangent, but it's such an uphill battle when the public doesn't know anything about. All they see is sad little cats and animals on commercials, you know, or whatever, and they don't understand all the good that happens from what. From our community, from what we do. So, I mean, again, going on off on a tangent, but I probably need to do a podcast on that and getting everybody involved in teaching the non-hunting public, not to bring them necessarily to bring them into hunting, but to actively and continuously educate non-hunters on why what you do is, you know, is the best thing for animals. So,
yeah.
But anyway,
education's key.
I think Randy fell asleep now.
Well, I had to take my geriatric nap. somebody, and I'm not sure who it was, called me old.
It was me. I'm sorry, buddy.
I said older. Older, yeah, that's yeah.
You're older
nice.
Than I.
Yeah, no,
I was
I'm
referring
awake now.
To the 80s.
Yeah, the 80s, back when I retired. Yeah, that's it.
Oh man.
So, yeah. Well, I want to thank you guys for coming on and you know, kind of sharing your opinion and bringing a little light to the subject. I don't know how many people this will touch and sway their opinions or anything, but I think it's important that when we're faced with issues like that within the community, that it just gets brought to light and people could just take a look at it and maybe think about what their opinion is and say, oh, you know what, maybe I should look into it a little bit more. Maybe I should stop looking down my nose at somebody because they do something this way or that way. But
yeah.
So
that's all you can hope for.
Yeah.
Different perspective.
All of you guys, at one point or another in this conversation, have mentioned that we have to stick together as hunters, and I think that's the most important thing that we do, and especially in social media where it's really open to anyone to look at. Mm-hmm. It's just like the compound versus recurve groups and all the arguments that they have. You guys have pointed out we all have to stick together and quit kind of stabbing each other in the back. And there are people out there that just like controversy and like to pound their chest. And hopefully the vast majority of us hunters will stick together and support one another.
Absolutely. Well, cool, guys. Thanks for coming on. And hope you guys all have an excellent season. Charles and I'll see you a couple of times. We're going to be hunting together some more. But Mark and Randy, hope you guys have a great season. And
you too. Nice to meet you, Charles.
Thank you. Yeah, great to meet all you guys. What a great conversation. Awesome. Thank you.
All right, you guys take care.
See you later.
Hey, guys. Want to stay connected with the podcast? Check out my blog, johnstallone.me. That's www.johnstallone.me. And you could go on there. On the top right-hand corner, there's a little subscribe box. Quickly put in an email address, hit subscribe, and boom, you're done. There's a lot of great information on there, a lot of posts that go hand-in-hand with the podcast that we do, plus gear reviews, plus we have the signature t-shirts on there, the I Eat Fast Food t-shirts, and the Tuesday Coosday shirts. It's a really good way to stay connected with the podcast. And thanks for listening.